Welcome today to our interview series with outstanding professionals. We are conducting an exclusive interview with Lee Benjamin, top-ranking international messaging architect and expert in Windows technologies, unified communications and messaging, Microsoft Exchange Server Architecture Most Valuable Professional, MCT, chairman of Exchange Server Boston, and secretary on the Global Board of Commonus. Lee, considering your very busy schedule, we thank you for doing this interview with us.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen. I'm always glad to share my thoughts.
Lee, can you profile your current roles and just how you got into computing?
Well, like Exchange has many roles, so do I, wearing different hats. Exchange Guy Consulting is my business name. I do direct client work. I work with customers on architectures and migrations, and though it says Exchange, but Exchange and UC, and we'll talk about all those words. I work with Microsoft partners, if you will, partners on strategy and white papers. I do a lot of speaking, as I know you do, seminars and webinars. I do some training and courseware and special events, and so that's the main part of my business. And then the other big side is the stuff that I do with user groups, and I know we'll talk a whole bunch about that as we go along today.
Well, Lee, you know, you are this highly recognized, kind of acknowledged expert, and because there's just tremendous history that you have. So we're going to drill into that now. Can you profile unified communications and the components that make up unified communications and what this means to organizations?
Sure. UC is an encompassing term that brings together a number of different technologies, more than email and messaging, and more than collaborative applications that we're used to in, along with email, like calendaring and group sharing. So if we start with that as a foundation, though actually it could be separate from UCS technologies, but add instant messaging, companies that need to be able to have conversations between individuals at any one particular time, group chat, so conversations of multiple people, audio and video technologies, web conferencing, and also voice. So these have been around in various different places, and UC really pulls them all together. And the key thing that ties all these pieces together is something called presence. If I can have that little indicator light that tells me the person is busy or available or away from their desk, that allows me to know what other technologies I can use to communicate with that person.
What specific industry solutions does Microsoft offer in this space, and how can each of them benefit organizations?
Well, Exchange is pretty much the preferred messaging and scheduling application of the majority of organizations today, regardless of industry or size. It's full-featured, it's scalable, it's dependable, and a combination of Exchange and Outlook, that's a known solution that IT organizations can place an easy, safe bet on, if you will. Office, of course, has been around for quite a while, and that includes Outlook for organizations. And so those are scalable. Those are, you know, beneficial technologies for Microsoft to present to the customers and for customer organizations to implement. Office Communication Server brings in a lot of the other capabilities that were mentioned above into a single product on the Microsoft platform. So now we have Exchange utilizing the message core messaging technologies that we're used to. We have OCS bringing in instant messaging and chat and audio and video conferencing, and be able to tie both of those products. They both use Active Directory as a single repository for the capabilities. So IT organizations can leverage one single infrastructure, two product capabilities that really function as one and that benefit each other, and that's quite useful to organizations.
Well, you have this remarkably long history with wide expertise in unified communications and messaging. Can you now overview Windows Exchange Server 2007 and Office Communication Server 2007?
Sure. There's a lot of similarities, but I'm going to step and draw us a virtual picture for a minute, because it's real helpful to introduce a whole bunch of different topics here, different capabilities, and really it's about architecture at this point. So let's just draw a virtual picture that traditionally we've got messaging servers with inside an organization talking to each other. And that's a role in Exchange. Exchange has five different roles, but that's the mailbox role. And it comes along with it, if you will, the hub transport, which is passing messages between the different servers internally. And we also have then, so the mailbox server, that's what we stores our messages, incoming and outgoing messages end up there, and that's where we pull messages and submit them to. We have a different role that is called the CAS, that is the client access server role. For those still on Exchange Server 2003, that was known as the front-end server, not exact name comparison, but close enough for what we want to do. And that is a role that takes client connections in from the internet, so that if I want to get my mail in lots of different ways, internally I may be probably using Outlook on the desktop. Great. But outside of the organization, I have a number of different client technologies that I could use. I might be using Outlook Web Access, and that Web Access talks to the CAS through my firewall. And I may also be using a mobile device, if that's a Microsoft Windows mobile device made by lots of different manufacturers, then that would also be talking in through the firewall, talking to the client access server, and I have connectivity that way. There are also a lot of hardware mobile device manufacturers now who license the Exchange Server ActiveSync protocol, or EAS. And for all of those, they're also synchronizing in through the firewall and through the CAS. Now, messages themselves come in and out of my organization as SMTP, Simple Mail Transport Protocol, or port 25. The interesting thing about port 25 coming in through the firewall is that protocol was designed as open, I don't want to say unsecure or insecure, but in effect it is. See, anybody needs to be able to send SMTP to anybody else. We'll come back to this because that introduces a bunch of problems in terms of abusing the capability of open communications, and that leads to spam and so on. So the picture that we've sort of just painted here is I have an organization with some internal messaging servers, and I have a firewall connecting or protecting between the outside world, where I have lots of other clients coming in, protecting through different technologies as part of Exchange and OCS. I'll sort of drag the, oh, I will expand that to OCS in just a minute here. But I need to protect the incoming traffic. I need to protect my users, and I need to provide the client functionality. Now, a little easier to do that on a chalkboard, but that gives you a sense for that. OCS has very similar concepts, so that we have some internal servers and capabilities to be able to work with our internal clients. And we also have the need to have secure communication from the outside world into our organization. And so we have some servers that are internal, like the CAS, the client access server for Exchange, but also a number of front-end server capabilities that are inside the network so that we can handle audio and video and web conferencing. And then we also have the concept of edge servers that work in conjunction with our firewall to do early protection for multiple ports and protocols that we need to protect. And so that gives you sort of an overall picture of what Exchange 2007 SP1 and OCS R2 look like. To get started here,
you know, that's a great sort of overview, and it provides a kind of foundation to this next question. And you know, there's a number of technologies present in Exchange Server 2007 SP1. Can you give some recommendations or tips on some of these technologies that are in this product?
Sure. Well, let's talk a little. Let's see. So Exchange has been around for quite a while. SP1 is an addition or an upgrade. Not an upgrade. It's a service pack. It adds some new features, but it fixes lots and lots of things. And it's actually been out for about a year now, as of the time that we're creating this interview here. Some of the big things that one needs to know about is the administrative interface that's really changed since 2003. There is now both a simplified administration console and also a scripting language. So PowerShell is the basis for all of Exchange 2007 and SP1, actually. It is a way of building commandlets and building standard ways of scripting, creating functionality for Exchange. Now, not every one of us wants to be a super scripter. That's okay. That's fine. But that scripting capability, or PowerShell, the Exchange Management Console, the GUI is actually built on top of PowerShell. So all of the PowerShell commands, some of them are exposed into the console so that people can use those commands from the normal click and point and graphical user interface that they're used to. One of the big things for 2007 Exchange SP1 when it came out was adding a whole bunch of things that many people wanted to be able to get to from the console, as opposed to having to know how to do script. Now, for a lot of us who are not super scripters, as I described, a lot of people are going to do, a lot of administrators will do cut and paste scripting, if you will. So if I go and I look in a help article and it says, hey, you need to run the following PowerShell command in order to do something that's not supported in the console itself. Well, it's cut and paste. So cut it from the document that you're reading or the help library, and there's these kind of one command PowerShell for Exchange all over the place. And I would cut that, and I would put that into a notepad, and I would edit it a tiny bit to say, okay, I need my server name, I need my organization name, here's what I named my storage stores. And then I can copy that and paste that right into the scripting window. So a lot of people are going to do that. Other things that we need to talk about or that are of interest in Exchange 2007, the mobility capabilities continue to grow. So having today, every one of us has some kind of mobile phone, and if it's a Windows Mobile or somebody who's licensed ActiveSync, I want to be able to get to connect up to Exchange from remote, but I also want to have more controls on my devices themselves. Now, I would do, if I was doing this in a live audience, and say, you know, how many of you have left a phone in a cab or perhaps on the security line at the airport, and only to realize an hour later when you're up at 30,000 feet that, oops, my phone is gone. I don't know where it is. So policies as part of mobile devices can be pushed down to the devices themselves and literally enforced on the devices to say, well, gee, after, let's say, 15 minutes, your device locks and you need to put in a password, and that password is 4 characters or 8 characters, maybe just numbers, maybe numbers and letters. And so we can get very explicit. We can also say that when somebody picks up my phone and tries to get into it, that after 8 failed attempts, the phone will not only reset itself, delete any information, and delete any information on any cards that you may have pushed into the device. And by the way, one night I was stupid enough to actually test that capability, and yes, after 8 times, it did a full wipe of the device. Very neat. We have security concerns with mobile devices today, and pretty much every device has a camera on the back of it today, every mobile phone. Well, security installations don't want people in there with mobile cameras, and so they might have said, no, you can't come in here with that. But now, other than taking a slight nail to the lens of the camera to prove that your camera was disabled, now in an auditable fashion, you can prove that phones can have the camera turned off. And so for anybody in this organization, phones are disabled, and they can prove that to an auditor so that security for the organization is maintained. The other thing that's always been in Exchange 2007 and in SP1 is unified messaging. unified messaging is a step towards unified communication that we're going to be talking about. Unified messaging allows us to have, to get my voice messages inside my inbox so that right alongside of my message and my meeting request is, here's a message, came in from this phone number, and it's a minute and 27 seconds in length. Double-click on that. You can play that either on your computer speakers or a nice little button inside of, this is Outlook voice access. You can also say play on phone. So this is the beginning of ties to unified communication, to adding additional technologies onto Exchange and then into OCS.
Well, those are really an interesting sort of survey of some of the technologies that are available, and you provided some really great insights. So I'm thinking, wow, if you did it for Exchange, can you do it for OCS 2007 R2?
Well, there's a lot of neat stuff in there as well, and OCS R2 is newer and really has some exciting pieces out to it. So the first thing is that a transition that Exchange made with Exchange 2007 a few years ago. OCS R2 is 64-bit software. And for a lot of organizations, that's a transition. It made sense with Exchange, though years ago people were very concerned. But by the time that Exchange rolled out, they already had every server hardware that you can buy today is a 64-bit server. It wasn't as much of an issue as people were concerned about. Many people are just beginning to implement OCS 2007 right now. And so R2, to implement that on 64-bit, not a problem. There's few organizations that implemented OCS 2007 when it first came out, or RTM, the release to manufacturing, the initial release, and those were actually 32-bit. So we need to recognize this is a 64-bit operating system now. So Windows Server 2008, 64-bit, is a 64-bit operating system, and Windows Server 2003 with SP2 can be a 32-bit or a 64-bit operating system. We need 64-bit because OCS is a 64-bit. Lots of reasons, scalability, additional protection, and that's the way that is. Some of the new capabilities jump into that. We have things that really excite me and that I think are interesting, the attended console. So all of a sudden we can actually now have a person in the organization that begins to do routing of incoming calls, if you will, and moving those to different locations. And like we used to do with incoming faxes, somebody's in charge, and now we could actually have, as we move towards enterprise voice, voice over IP, which is part of UC, a part of unified communication, we can actually now have a person sit down and have on their computer an attendant console so that they can direct calls. For organizations that are getting heavily into enterprise voice, there's a concept of SIP trunking. SIP is the protocol or the technology that voice over IP uses. And there's an interesting disconnect between the fact that we typically work with what are called plain old telephone servers, or POTS, POTS lines from our telephone carriers. All right, those are analog phone lines, two-wire, typically coming into your organization, and you go and buy them in bunches and groups. But SIP trunking recognizes the fact that our telephone carriers are actually fully digital between all of their locations. Okay, the telephone backbone of the countries and pretty much of the world today is a digital technology. And so why should I have to convert digital technology on the outside world into plain old telephone lines to get it back into my organization and then convert it into digital, because now we're entering the enterprise voice area. So SIP trunking basically says, hey, from my digital carrier, I can have a pipe that comes into my organization. Perhaps that pipe is fiber. And that comes into my organization, and I can have multiple services within that robust trunk, if you will. Some other fun things, single number calling, so that I can have my phone, one phone number for me, ring in multiple locations. Perhaps it rings on my desk. Perhaps it rings on my office phone number in my my home office, and perhaps it also rings on my cell phone device, so single number calling. I could go on and on, but those are some of the top ones that that appeal to me.
Well, that's a fascinating kind of overview of the, you know, the technologies present in those products. You know, sometimes you have IT pros and they're saying, geez, you know, we're going to have to do some installation of Exchange Server and OCS, and I wish we had somebody with a lot of experience that they could share some of their wisdom with us. So do you have some tips on that area?
So every product is different, and you need to, one obviously needs to understand the environment. Years ago, people would ask me, you know, how do you learn Exchange? And this could easily be extended to OCS. And my answer was, you know, install it 10 or 20 times. And I, of course, said it jokingly, but that actually is really the truth. The more times you install it, the more times you work with it, get your hands on it. So today, practicing in a virtual environment is very easy to do. You can go online and you can sign up for different labs in order to be able to try out different pieces. But you can also download virtual environments to kick the tires and understand how to do that. Extending that out is really to build a lab. Now, labs used to be a very expensive proposition for organizations. I remember just one particular, you know, organization where, we're doing about a 2,000 user rollout, not that large, but it was distributed around the world at the time. And I think we brought in 10 servers, in order to, 10 servers and about 4 or 5 client machines, in order to mimic their environment so that we could test out the functionality and work with their way of doing things and how they were organized and how their networks were set up. Today, we can use virtual technology in order to be able to test products like Exchange and OCS. So for anything but performance testing, we can virtualize. So one of the best tricks that's out there is to actually clone your live environment. Clone the Active Directory environment that you have today. Maybe you're working with an earlier version of Exchange 2003, and you're looking at upgrading. Maybe you've already put in OCS, the initial release. Clone that environment, actually. Pull that information into a virtualized environment, obviously isolated from the live environment, so that we don't have conflicts. But in that environment now, in a virtualized, you could have on one beefy server your entire network laid out as it is, and you could actually, you know, save the state as you go along to actually test out your migration, to improve your procedures, to work through any issues, and to do the same thing with putting in a parallel infrastructure, let's say for OCS, or adding new capabilities, and then that's something that you can keep up and running as you need it, so much less cost to an organization. So those are some thoughts to get you going with installing it.
Well, I guess a natural extension to that question is then, well, I've got some Exchange Server 2007s out there and some OCS 2007s, and hey, now I've got to manage them. And, you know, you do a lot of consulting for all sorts of organizations around the world. What are your recommendations in this area?
Well, the first thing is, yes, you really do need to manage these. As with any sophisticated server products, they're not going to manage themselves. You need to watch them, listen to them, and see what they're trying to tell you. The first area is really about looking at the event logs on your different servers. The event logs want to tell you when something is going awry, when there's a problem. And the real question is for organizations is whether they pay attention to those warning signs or they don't. Now, there's way too many event logs and event log entries on multiple servers for any human being to actually read through, though not a bad idea to take your junior level entry IT administrator and make them do that for a little while, because they'll learn some good things. But what one really wants today is either an event log consolidation program or an event log analyzer to really go through and figure out, tell you what are the five most important things on a particular server on a particular day that you need to deal with, and maybe even provide some guidance for understanding what those issues are. The other, that's sort of on your daily, what do you need to do kind of thing. The other area that Microsoft has put a lot of effort into, and these are really, really incredible applications, are called the Best Practices Analyzers. So Microsoft developed, actually initially for internal use, but for product support, was trying to figure out, how do my product support engineers get on the same page, get on the same understanding as a customer who's calling in with a problem? Because the problem is not just a single server. The problem could be multiple servers, has to do with Active Directory and how DNS is set up and what their firewall potentially looks like. And so the Best Practices Analyzer, or initially for Exchange and now for OCS and most of the Microsoft Server products, when you run these applications, they pull down from Microsoft an XML file of over 2,000 data points about Exchange and Active Directory and the hardware that it's running on and BIOS levels and not necessarily which antivirus product is installed, but is there an antivirus product installed and is it relatively up to date? And then it compares that information that it has just pulled. It's all read-only from about, like I said, you give it up on keeping track of the number of data points that it collects, but well over 2,000. And then it compares those to quote-unquote best practices. Now, best practices may or may not be exactly what you need to do in your particular organization, but from the reports, from the Best Practices Analyzer reports, there's a good description that says, hey, here's something that has been found in your organization. This is not typically the way it's done. That doesn't say it's not your way to do it. And here's a description of some special articles, or lots of special articles, up on the TechNet hierarchy that really describe, okay, what's the issue, why this may be a concern, and what you may want to do in order to fix it or to change it. Now, you can also right-click on any of these items and say, hey, don't bother me about this again. I know. Now, another area this is particularly useful is, let's just say you get hit by a bus, and new administrator comes in and has to look at your environment, and they can actually run the Best Practices Analyzer. They can look at all of the different settings, and there's a little choice there that says, show me all the ones that I told you not to show me previously, and so that they can understand your environment as well. Anyway, I can't say enough about the Best Practices Analyzer. As a consultant, one of the first things that I run after talking to the customer a little bit, let me get a feeling for what's going on in your organization, how it's configured. And sometimes I'll even do this as I'm talking to somebody over email and on the phone before I engage a client, which is, hey, let me take a peek. I think I know what's going on, but let me take a peek at a snapshot of your organization. And that's what the Best Practices Analyzers can do. Really great help in managing Exchange and OCS.
So what are your top lessons then for Exchange and OCS architecture?
So with architecture, we really need to understand how to scale it for your particular environment, how to build it so that it continues to be secure. I know that we'll talk security things as we move along a little bit more. Your particular requirements and loads is fundamental to building Exchange and building OCS architectures and servers. See, if I have an organization that's got, anywhere from, 100 to, a couple of thousand users, the load on my Exchange servers is going to be very different than an organization with tens of thousands of users and who are very, very active on their particular servers. So even in a small infrastructure, because of the additional functionality that OCS brings along, single server environments that we used to think of previously, become multi-server environments, because there's some things that I could put on servers together, some things that I really shouldn't do that. And I know we'll talk about virtualization a little bit later as well, but the loads and the kinds of things that we're doing as we move from messaging, which is a non-real-time protocol. I know some users, you know, really get upset if their messages don't show up for 15 seconds, but the truth is messaging has always been a not real-time protocol. But when we're dealing with audio and video, those are real-time. Those and enterprise voice, voice over IP, those are real-time, and I need to really pay attention to the loads and peak times and off-peak times and so on. These are things that telephony people used, you know, always knew. But now that we're moving these technologies into computer servers that we manage together, we need to really be intentional about. And there's various calculators and spreadsheets that are out there in order to figure out that says, hey, how many users or how many of what types of users can I support on existing bandwidth, or where will I need additional bandwidth? I did a project years and years ago where the project was to consolidate. The question was, the company had two major locations and had about 40 different branch offices. And the question was, do I leave all those servers out in the branch offices, or do I pull those back, have additional servers in the two centralized locations, and what will I need for bandwidth between those two locations? At the time, this is probably about 10 years ago, at the time, that was a very, you know, brave or new thing to do. There were cost savings there, needed to beef up the networks between those locations, but in order to have end up with that hardware consolidated, my expertise, my administrative people, in a single or the dual headquarters locations, ended up being a huge cost savings for those organizations.
In all of your work, you're involved with Exchange and OCS migration. Can you share some comments or views in that area or recommendations?
Oh, sure. So the real question with Exchange migration, and then we'll come back to OCS in a moment, Exchange migration really is the platform that you're coming from. There have been more challenging upgrades for Exchange and less challenging upgrades for Exchange, depending on the versions that you've come from. What's been learned over the years, however, is that Exchange really works best in a move mailbox scenario, and we don't even call it an upgrade. We call it a transition, because there's no upgrade in place let's say, an Exchange 2003 server to an Exchange 2007 server for some of the same reasons that we talked about OCS before, the 32-bit, 64-bit transition. So we work with Move Mailbox. We build a new server next to the old server. It's running a 64-bit operating system, Windows Server 2008 or Windows Server 2003 64-bit. And we then begin to move the mailboxes over, so transition those mailboxes. And it's a fairly seamless transition. The things that you need to think of, move the mailboxes is relatively easy. Plan it, test it, measure it, and go ahead and do it. We need to think about all of the things peripheral to that. And the guidance, if you will, inside the Exchange setup program and inside the Exchange management console actually will guide you through some of these, but we need to think about and say, okay, what other connectors do I need to worry about? Do I have, where's my connector to the internet? When do I move that? How do I move that? How do I test that? Do I have other connectors? Maybe you have a connector, maybe you have some fax services that you're providing, and so need to talk to that particular vendor. Obviously, Windows Mobile resides within Exchange itself, but for organizations that have BlackBerry devices, mobile devices, they may be running a BlackBerry server, BlackBerry Enterprise Server, BEZ server, right next to their Exchange server, and need to work with BlackBerry as well, RIM, in order to know what are the what are the best steps to take so that your users are supported on both the old versions and the new versions? With OCS, it's a little bit trickier, again, between OCS release version and OCS R2, which came out a few months ago. Little bit trickier in order to handle migration, but there aren't that many customers that really got past the pilot stage in that first period of time before R2 came out. So for those organizations, they may need to do a parallel infrastructure as they move capabilities over, but for most organizations, R2 is the starting point, if you will.
So if we were to extend that then to your recommendations on Exchange and OCS upgrading, what would you say?
Really very similar to sort of what we just talked about. The word upgrade goes away. In fact, the word migration is not quite right, but let me expand on that. So we don't have an upgrade in place for these. We can do transition, and transition is really a capability of moving mailboxes and moving capabilities over. Migration, I would have to define, and Microsoft would define as well, is coming from either an Exchange organization where you need to change the organization name, which is a tricky thing to do with inside of Active Directory, or coming from an older Exchange version that's not supported in transition, like coming from Exchange 5.5, or migrating from a non-Exchange platform, say coming from Lotus Notes or some other platform. For each of those, there are, you know, very specific steps. How do you migrate? What are the tools that are available? What capabilities exist? They're well-defined, but you really, really need to do testing to, one, understand the process, two, to understand the tools that are available, both from Microsoft and from other third-party organizations. You may determine that says, I need additional functionality in my migration from these other platforms, or I need support that Microsoft doesn't provide, and you may go to third parties for those capabilities in order to migrate.
Can you tell us about the other parts of your consulting, training, seminars, and webinars, and working with partners on strategy and positioning?
Sure. I know I do a number of different things, and that falls into two areas. One is I do a fair amount of working with doing seminars for different companies or different websites, if you will, to do seminars for them or webinars. I do speaking engagements at events like Exchange Connections and OCS Connections and also TechEd. And I do different kinds of events like that. And I really enjoy that kind of stuff. It's just fun to get up in front and talk to people about how do you do this or how do you do that or, you know, and answer their questions as you move along. Along with that, I do some work with the partner community around add-on products for the Exchange and the OCS world. So having been inside of Microsoft and outside of Microsoft, there are both good add-ons for Exchange and OCS and not-so-good add-ons for Exchange and OCS. Some of those capabilities, you know, or some of those qualities are how well they work with Exchange and how well they work with the administrative interface of the two products that we're talking about and how seamless they are and how much trouble to install. And often I'll work with some of these organizations to help them figure out, you know, hey, what's the right strategy for that company moving forward to entice the administrators that they really want to work with their particular products. And all kinds of different things. Sometimes that gets into strategy, and sometimes it's white papers, and sometimes it's just saying, hey, if you want to go this way, you got to think about these particular things. If that's not important to you, chances are you're not going to get the heart and mind, if you will, of the Exchange administrators or OCS administrators, and that's going to make it harder for you. And so that's a fun part of my business as well, to work with them and figure out what's the best way that they can work their add-on products into sympathetic relationship with Exchange and OCS technologies.
You know, you're this established guru, and you do these seminars, training. As you just indicated, you consult, you advise partners on strategy and positioning. Let's see if you can now encapsulate some of that experience in providing best practices for Exchange Server.
We've already talked, really, Exchange, the best practices itself is manage it well. Like any sophisticated system, it's not going to run itself. Use the tools and the technologies that are out there to pay attention to what's actually going on. Your network is critical as well. Exchange or Outlook is a great network trouble detector. So the truth is that every network has fluctuations. Every network has performance issues that come and go. And Outlook by itself has been very, very sensitive, or any mail client can be very, very sensitive to real-time issues like that. Protocols are built to be more resilient to those sorts of things. So it's Outlook now and Exchange support a cache mode so that people don't experience the little tiny hiccups on the network. Now, we need to do same kinds of things with OCS. That is, we need to manage our networks well, make sure that they're in good shape, have utilities and tools to tell us when things are going on that are not. But OCS has built-in resiliency with protocols as well, but now we're dealing with even more real-timeness, if you will. In the area of best practices on OCS, the other one really is to take your time. Do not try to implement all of the OCS technologies at once, or if you do, make sure that you've done enough testing so that you will have a successful deployment of all those technologies. Typically, organizations will say, hey, I'm going to start working with I've got Exchange already. Let's build in the unified messaging capability so that I could have voicemail inside my inbox. And, gee, if I tie in a little bit to some of my phone lines, I can have Outlook voice access. Great. That's a first step. Bringing in OCS then adds capabilities to unified messaging as well. But then I can start looking and saying, okay, what I really need next is web conferencing. And so build on the web conferencing, the live meeting capability of OCS, where you can now have live meetings inside your organization, just the same as you have them outside your organization, and you can scale those up or federate those technologies together so that you can build those pieces a bit at a time. And that's really a best practice for OCS so that you're building and you're adding, you're layering in the additional services that it makes available, but also go at it reasonably so that your user population, so that you can train them so that they can understand what are the different pieces that you're adding. Set up for failure is to put in all of OCS and just think it's going to work with no training or no preparation of your organization. And as we know from any technology, too much all at once is really setting yourself up for a troublesome time.
You know, it's clear from our conversation to this point in our interview that you've been around for a long time and you've worked with a variety of different environments. So I'm thinking, well, maybe you could mine that experience, you know, because that experience has a lot of richness to it. So, you know, from your experiences or best lessons, what can you tell us about deploying, migrating, managing, and running these solutions?
Well, I think we've covered a lot of them already. There's a lot of guidance that's out there that would help you. It would help any organization. And knowing where those are, we'll list out some of them, I think, in a few minutes here. But deploying the pieces, which is understanding your organization, understanding what your requirements are, how it compares to other organizations. Obviously, firewall experience is an across-the-board capability or understanding that the exchange administrator needs to, exchange and OCS really needs to understand, and that is more and more so working with the different parts of your organization. When you get into not just the OCS capabilities like audio and video and web conferencing, but as you get into tying together your voicemail system and getting into enterprise voice, you need to work with people who are experts in that area. Voice over IP is really exciting. Having it all integrated and talking to all of the different mobile devices or mobile client connectivity options is really exciting. But the people who've been working with that, the telephony people, they need to be brought on board as well. And the telephony world, as we move from just the messaging world and into the telephone world, has its own ways of doing things, its own acronyms, its own specialized capabilities for figuring out how voice connections are made. And you're going to need their expertise, but you also need to have those people be your partners and peers moving forward with all of these technologies, so that whether it's how do we deploy it and planning, and how do we get migrate from one to the other, how do we manage on a day-to-day basis, and how do we know what's actually going on, your teams are changing internally. You know, it used to be that the telephone person was the guy who got the telephone bills dropped on their desk. And as telephone lines became more important and deregulation and 800 numbers and all of that, it's a very specialized area. And you need to really have a good relationship between your server administration and architecture teams and your telephone teams.
You know, your answer to the last question kind of brings into this, at least it provides a picture in my mind that, you know, you're always interfacing with different people. And in that process of interfacing and solving client problems, then you hear about top challenges and their solutions, and you provide those solutions to these things. So what are the top challenges and their solutions that you hear about most in your work with Unified Communications, and then specifically Exchange and OCS?
One of the top challenges is the firewall and understanding how protocols come into and out of the organization. Because we used to know where that dividing line was. We used to know where the firewall was. And now that has changed. Now that we have mobile devices that are connecting in from all kinds of different ways, whether it's web or it's synchronizing mail or having an audio conference that is both with people inside the company and outside the company. And so one of those biggest challenges is, and things that administrators of these technologies really need to understand is firewalls. That doesn't mean that it will be your expertise, but that you can stand toe-to-toe with the people who have those expertises and work with them in order to have a process so that when the blame comes at you, you don't just throw the blame to the firewall guy, even though you know it's the firewall guy or gal that really is the problem, but that you can work with those people in order to have a problem resolution, have a methodology for how do you get past those tricky points. Other challenges are about, obviously, in today's world, one of the biggest challenges is economics, right, the economy. And there will be some organizations that, unfortunately, with the economy, cut back on training dollars and, you know, find other ways to get your training and get understanding. There are organizations that will determine that, say, with the economy, we can't do any upgrades this year. We can't buy anything this year. To other organizations who say, you know what, because we're not buying, putting on the back burner some of the projects that we've had for this year, gee, maybe there are projects that we could do in the infrastructure arena that would not be costly to us. Perhaps your organization has licensing and so on, so that you could repurpose hardware and actually upgrade the servers in the background. This might be a good year to do that. So that's something to look at, and obviously the economy, but figure out how you can work with your budgetary requirements and restraints. But perhaps it's find ways to implement technologies that really will benefit the bottom line of the company. More technologies that people have been saying, you know, this would be useful if I only had the time, and something to take a look at.
I was talking to some IT pros the other day, and they indicated that they're always looking for resources, you know, resource links, presentations, podcasts, downloads. And again, during a conversation today, it's clear, you know, you've indicated you do webcasts and you training and seminars and consulting. So you probably have sort of this list of what you consider to be the best resources. Can you share them with us, both with Exchange and OCS?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'll share with you some of them, but I can't call them the best because there's so many that are out there, and calling something the best gets us in trouble, right? But some of the most popular, I mean, obviously, you know, first thing that I've got to think of for the Microsoft technologies is TechNet itself. So technet.microsoft.com and, you know, the Exchange under there and OCS. I mean, the amount of presentation materials, both in fully download or, you know, listen, watch and listen to webinars from Microsoft people on the Microsoft technologies, also downloading white papers and raw presentations, you know, tons of that that's out there. One of the places that that I really you know, use a lot and look for, well, actually, sometimes I just go out searching for presentations all over the place. Some of the consulting companies and others will have presentations. Going to conferences, again, it's a hard year because of the economy, but coming back from the most recent Exchange and OCS and Windows Connections conference that was earlier, let's see, March 2009 in Orlando, and typically they have a November in Las Vegas. But coming back with a CD or DVDs of all those presentations is really a great way to come back and look and say, I heard about this technology. Let me go take a look at it. Podcasts, plenty of places to download from Microsoft and others. And my really great tip here is, make a CD for the car. So obviously, some of you can plug in your various MP3 devices directly into your car stereo. I've never figured out how to make that happen, but I'll often put together a CD for the week or for the month of just interesting podcasts that I've downloaded, and gee, throw it in. I can listen to them anytime. Community sites. Obviously, there are lots out there for Exchange and OCS. Multiple blogs, both from the Exchange and OCS teams themselves, some favorites, but they come and go all of the time. The thing I've learned about blogs is the question really is, what's your current information that you're looking for? Culminus and Ineta, to sort of jump in, are organizations that really promote IT advancement within Culminus for the IT pro and Ineta for the developer community. And they have a lot of cross-product or cross-technology expertise that they make available through their websites as well as promoting between user groups. A favorite one for getting started is msexchange.org. And this is an organization that, or a community website that puts together articles that are, give me step by step on how do I implement a particular piece of technology in the Exchange and OCS space. So having a document that sort of you can work through, how do I implement this with pictures, some of us need pictures to think about, is very useful. Now, you may not do it exactly that way, but at least it opens up for you to give you a broad brushstroke of what are the steps necessary to implement a particular feature. Let's see. I think about books. Books, I have to give my usual answer, and I've been giving this answer for probably over 20 years as well. And books is a very is something that's very particular to the individual user. And so what I really have to recommend is favorite authors don't matter. What matters is going into a good bookstore with a good selection of technical books. You can find, you know, 10 or 20 on exchange, any particular version, OCS. There are, you know, 5 or 6 books out now. And literally go and leaf through those books for a while, because that's where you're going to figure out, is this the right style for me? Do I like lots of condensed text with no pictures, or do I need lots of pictures and colors? And that's really the way to pick the book for you that's actually going to work. You'll figure out very quickly which books are sort of repeating information versus which ones are really going to help me in my daily chores managing. Some of the other resources, obviously, I'm heavily into the user group world that we talked about, and through Culminus websites or here, and Ineta as well on the developer side, but those are great local resources as well. And one that we started off talking about today, I'm going to come back to, which is the idea of virtual labs, the ability to kick the tires on a particular technology or set of features. And if you either under the TechNet hierarchy, but easier to find TechNet virtual labs. And you can go and schedule, you know, 1 hour on how do I use Exchange? How do I set up standby continuous replication, let's say, between two site locations, two of my corporate locations, in order to build resiliency so that in a disaster I actually have another copy of Exchange. TechNet virtual labs. Great, great resource for getting some hands-on.
Do you have any recommendations on downloads? I know that's a tough one, so.
Yeah, best practices analyzer. So I am always amazed. I talk about best practices analyzer, and still there's always people in the audience who've never heard of it. And you will learn more about your organization with best practices analyzer than you will with probably anything else. We've talked about, you know, event viewers and so on, some of which are available free, some of which are built into pieces like Microsoft System Center in order to be able to pull that information back. So downloads really depends on what's needed specifically and so on. I'm not going to jump in there.
You know, we see this news about hosted services, and I know Microsoft is moving in this area for messaging. Can you describe what this involves and your advice for maximizing on this solution?
Sure. I mean, hosted. So first, let's talk for a second about hosted services versus hosted messaging. Just to sort of clarify, the distinction between these is disappearing, but it's helpful right now. Hosted services are things like putting message hygiene, antivirus and anti-spam out on the internet as a service. And that's been around for a number of years. There are a number of vendors, including Microsoft, in that space. And Microsoft, it's a great solution, works well, you know, directly with Exchange, but get the load of, malware, that comes in through email on a regular basis, spam, particularly, or phishing, and let's get that stuff off the network, but keep it off the network. So you didn't build your corporate network in order to be able to handle 90% additional traffic. So if you use an outside service, we can get rid of that on the outside. Now, hosted messaging is hosting Exchange mailboxes themselves, and so the client's Outlook or Outlook Web Access or mobile devices connect up to the hosted mailboxes, hosted messaging capabilities. Now, Microsoft is into this area as well, and a very big investment in this moving forward. Hosted services moving forward includes both hosted services like antivirus, anti-spam, and perhaps continuity services and compliance archiving with hosted messaging. We've yet to really determine what size and what types of organizations that will where hosted messaging will really appeal. Microsoft believes that this will be a very large part, and I think they're right. I think we just don't know exactly, again, which pieces will want to be there. Whether it's a very small organization who, you know, who only has a few users, that's a relatively easy decision. Medium organizations may have tougher time with letting go of the crown jewels, if you will. So if I don't have my messages on my own server, you know, do I have that information? And obviously anybody who signs a services agreement with any provider out on the internet really needs to make sure that their legal departments are involved so that they're protecting their information no matter what. But I think we'll see some medium organizations begin to do what I'm calling a split organization, where some of their users are internal, they're on their own internal services, and some users, perhaps, let's say, a sales organization or a support organization, actually gets outsourced into the hosted arena. This is going to be interesting to watch.
So what are your challenges, solutions, and recommendations on interoperability between Microsoft solutions and other platforms?
Well, let's see. We talked a little bit before about the concept of upgrades that don't really pan out or don't really have a – we don't use that word anymore because there's no upgrades in place. We're moving to transition, which is really staying on the same platform, and it's an easy moving mailboxes across, and that leads us to really the migration scenarios coming across from other platforms like Notes, Lotus Notes or Domino and Notes. So one really needs to think about in this particular arena the question of Notes Domino really does two things. It is both a messaging application and it's an application platform. Moving the messaging pieces across, which is really how I send mail, we have a concept of mailbags that has to become get into mailboxes, but there's technologies and gateways, migration tools in order to bring those across. Bringing across the applications is also possible, but it's a different animal. And so organizations that are looking at moving, need to spend additional time in looking at what are these applications, how do they relate to the business, how are they constructed, and building up teams and technologies, either in the Microsoft custom code area or looking at SharePoint and extending out SharePoint applications to seeing what fits best in the Microsoft world, and building up a team of people who can, outside or internal people, who can build those into Microsoft platforms, web platforms, and using the different technology.
You know, you touched on this sort of idea earlier. You know, you're talking about mobility and mobile access and so forth. So can we drill down further? You know, do you have some tips in that area?
Well, let's see. We've talked about, the distinction before about Windows mobile devices. Those are devices from various hardware manufacturers that have licensed Windows mobile. Exchange Active Sync, so a whole bunch of other mobile vendors who have licensed Exchange, licensed the Exchange Active Sync protocol so that they can be managed through the mobile arena, through the Exchange and then the OCS pieces. And then there's BlackBerry and Bez, BlackBerry Enterprise Server, and those that have their own ways of communicating in. We layer on top of this more than Exchange, right? We need to now worry about having these policies, but also adding in the additional capabilities. So adding in instant messaging back to corporate, adding in audio conferencing onto our mobile devices. And the real tips around all of this are really about, one, securing these devices with policies. There's the fun story, of course, you know, for somebody whose, you know, phone in their pocket dials another phone number. And that's a security violation and things that we need to really be careful about. Losing these devices with more and more information and more access, on these pieces. And we gotta keep this simple. It's got to appear, that all the user does is click on a mobile application and they're connected. Obviously everything we do in the background has got to, measure, the connectivity and the throughput and delay and all of those sorts of things so that the, experience for the end user is, beneficial, is optimal as it can be.
So you already touched upon this, and then you mentioned this idea of security. Can you go into more detail what the IT pro should know about messaging security?
Sure. The simple answer is everything. Okay, that's fun. But the truth is, messaging today is the high-value target. Exchange and Outlook is king of the hill. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but it's reality. And the reality is that whoever's the king of the hill is going to get attacked, beaten up more than anybody else. So if it were not Outlook that was the king of the hill with the most clients, whatever that other target, whatever that other solution would be the top target that's out there. And so we need to really figure out how to protect those different pieces. Exchange builds in a lot of that capability natively, and there are firewall solutions both from Microsoft and others that can help understand what those targets are, what the vulnerabilities are. And one of the things I love about Microsoft's firewall ISA server, which becomes the threat management gateway in its next release sometime in the next year or two, is really the ability to understand how Outlook and Outlook Web Access and OWA and, moving forward, OCS Voice and OCS Video, how those protocols, how the packets actually looked in order to be able to figure out this is a good, safe packet for one of the UC applications. And this is a malformed packet. This is a packet that's trying to cause trouble. And Microsoft knows its packets, knows its protocols better than anybody else will. And putting in an additional layer of protection, let's call it a messaging or a UC or a threat gateway, right? So that I have a firewall or a gateway that's just for that purpose. Maybe that's in addition to or separate from your existing firewalls. Some places in the world love ISA and implement it as their primary and secondary firewalls. Other places are, no, I have my X, Y, or Z firewall and I'm not trading it for anything. Great. Bring in something like ISA that understands the individual packets in for these specific protocols and put that in as an additional layer of protection for those organizations. The other things that we need to worry about are just the volume of classic threats. And this is where having, taking a serious look at the services that are provided for message hygiene out on the Internet from Microsoft and others to get that down to a reasonable number that actually reaches your network itself. We got new threats because we have new protocols. As we bring in voice over IP and the other UC technologies, those are going to be new protocols, and they're going to become the king of the hill. So the threats around messaging security will not go away, but we'll continue to get better and watching those, and our firewalls will grow up, the access servers will grow up, and we're also seeing something, gee, we haven't really touched on all through this, but I sort of have it as a given, if you will, which is everything's coming in today with SSL secure sockets layer. So if we're coming in on a web packet, that's with port 443. If we're coming in as SMTP, while SMTP itself, port 25, is a wide open protocol, there are pieces like transport layer security, SSL by another name, that can automatically be turned on between any two SMTP servers that talk transport layer security. So more and more of our protocols are coming in encrypted. That will help, and we need to continue to make sure that we do encrypt those things, but also that we can look at look down to the protocol level and the packet level to understand what traffic is coming in and where it's safe and potentially where it's not.
Lee, and looking at your background, you have consulted in data protection. Do you have some best practices in that area?
Well, there are the classic areas that we need to protect, which is the diagram doesn't go away that talked about protecting at multiple levels of the organization, right? That was kind of the way we did things forever. Protect down at the workstation level, protect at the server level, protect at the internal network level or the gateway level, and protect again out to the outside world. And we've added sort of the level to this of the mobile device. And so one of the protection levels that have come into being in the last couple of years, but also a quarantine level so that we can make sure that anybody who connects to and gets onto our networks actually has adequate protection and antivirus and latest patches and so on. The one thing we know in the area of data protection is, more just computers in general, is our users will do the wrong thing no matter what. It's unfortunate, but it's really true. If you ask people not to do something, they will go right out and do it. If you put that in, more coached phrasing and so on, they will still figure out what it is that you don't want them to do, and they will do that. So what do we need to do? We need to protect our users from themselves in most cases. We need to put auto updates on desktops and laptops. If you think about, the threats that do come down and the fact that people, have devices and, let's say they're laptops and they're in hotel rooms, and those devices are going to get attacked left and right because they're on, hotel wireless networks. We really need to make sure they're patched and updated all the time. Once in a while you may end up with a small problem on a couple of different machines, but if you think percentage-wise, that's probably better than putting that off for a period of time, a week or two, and then recognizing and saying, wait a minute, I've got an internal attack because somebody got infected, got their machine infected when they were traveling and brought it back to the corporate network. Servers, we take a little bit more cautiously. I don't recommend that auto updates happen on individual servers themselves, but your IT group has to have a process in place make sure that updates are looked at and applied in a relatively timely manner for those pieces. And then the last area in data protection is really about policies. Policies, both the technology policies that we've talked about, particularly on mobile devices, but also Active Directory group policies within how people can modify their machines and things like that. But we're back to also let's not forget about written policies within your organization, specifically on data use or network use, and also we can talk a little bit about on data retention themselves. So, again, users will do the wrong thing, but you'd like to have them know that they're doing the wrong thing. And so typically I'm not your lawyer or legal advisor here, but written policies on the use of your network, such that if there were a severe violation, your people have read that, perhaps signed a document once a year that says that they've read that, and that if you need to take action, you have some prior history to go back to.
Can you share any additional ideas, let's say, in the compliance and e-discovery areas?
Sure. Well, we just started that with talking about retention. But basically, compliance is a much more hot topic in the last couple of years and moving forward, compliance being regulations for Securities and Exchange Commission or stock trading, perhaps in the area of healthcare and in the U.S. here, HIPAA, Health Insurance Portability and Accountability Act. But lots of ways that organizations are now more responsible for making sure that certain information stays internal or is only seen by people who are authorized to see it, or if it goes out external, that it's encrypted. So protecting in that space, also protecting against intellectual property theft. So it's not that hard to run reports to look at and say, where are my people sending and receiving email from? You know, if my product development team is sending a ridiculous amount of messages back and forth to my chief competitor, that would be a red flag in the area of compliance, right? If I have messages that are going outside of the organization with product code names, I probably don't want that to occur. And so starting off with reporting, but really getting more sophisticated after that, these are areas that you need to protect against. E-discovery is in the legal arena, which is I need to search back through mail, back through archives, or other types of communication records in order to be able to answer potential lawsuits and requests for the discovery from legal teams that my organization may or may be involved in. Microsoft has really always been really great at providing plumbing and capabilities. So there are tools inside of Exchange in order to make archiving, which is the keeping of this information, easier. There's journaling technology and to make copies of messages. There's log shipping, which Microsoft uses inside of replication technologies. And these are good areas to help capture this information. Microsoft has, with Exchange 2007 in particular, has improved the ability to make sure that every single message is captured. Also to put in the concept of transport rules, that is like your Outlook rules or your rules in your messaging client, rules on the server level that the administrators can work with. So look for those code words or look for compliance issues. And if something is seen, take a particular action on it. Third parties are still the experts in this space to take that base functionality or build on the Microsoft plumbing and apply their expertise and their technologies on top. An old line, what's the best time to start archiving? And the answer is before you get in trouble, before you need to go back and look for that information. It is not a fun exercise for any organization if they had to go back and mount backup tapes for the last 6 months, 12 months, 3 years in order to be able to go looking for messages of a particular type or call detail records coming off of OCS and Enterprise Voice that deal with a particular set of phone numbers and so on. To get that information is going to be a lot of work. And so the earlier that you actually start building that enterprise archive that deals with messaging data and audio and video and voice over IP, the better, the easier time you're going to have of pulling up that data. Again, here in the U.S., the federal rules of civil procedures that came down, I guess, a little over a year ago and have gotten a little bit more clarified now, basically say if you have been requested legally to provide information, you must provide it in a reasonable amount of time. That can be a challenge in itself if you don't have a way to get back and pull all that information.
You know, IT pros are always looking at certification and the benefits from it and so forth. So what are your recommendations around Microsoft certification exams in this whole area of unified communications?
Well, I've taken a lot of these exams over the years, and I've messed up a couple of them. And there's a story in there that will be helpful in just a moment. So these tests, the Microsoft certifications are not meant to be easy. They are valuable to those who are looking because it tells prospective employers that you understand the technology more than just cracking the books. But the tests are not meant to be easy. You're not going to get them just by cracking a book. Recommendations are classic. Take a class, read some books, get the hands-on, and then go and take your first test. Now, I guarantee you that the first time you take one of the Microsoft certified exams, that you're going to be under pressure, and it's an exam a little bit different than you may be familiar with. So don't be surprised if you blow the first one. It's a learning experience. You need to understand how does Microsoft structure these kinds of exams and questions. They're not looking for memorization, but you need to be able to pull out from a particular set of questions the pertinent facts in order to come up with the solution that a Microsoft exam would look for. So if you take that first one and you have trouble with it and you don't pass it, it's not the end of the world. Go and study some more. Go and do some more hands-on and retake it in a couple of weeks, and chances are you will do much better with it. So the certification arena is an area where companies can send people internally because it helps keep them sharp, and some organizations will work with employees to help pay for some of those. Other organizations won't, but still, it's in your best interest should you ever want to be out on that job market or talking to other people. It has value, and employers know that.
Well, you talked about this idea of taking a class and so on in your answer here. So would you then have any sort of recommendations for Microsoft Learning?
Learning has changed. There are lots of additional ways to get up to speed to on technologies, including the Exchange pieces and the OCS pieces that we're talking about. E-learning could be a great cost saving for your organizations, the ability to take those classes online rather than going off-site and sitting in on a full-week training class, let's say. The trade-off to that, however, is applying the same amount of dedicated time and not being pulled away by your day job, by the operational concerns that you have in particular. With fiscal belt tightening, training dollars may get scaled back or cut outright. So look for the other things that are out there. Look for seminars. Look for virtual labs. Look for user groups that are people talking on different topics. Look for, after any large, conference, let's say, Tech Ed, a number of the Tech Ed sessions, Tech Ed around the world, but a number of sessions, some get broadcast live. Other Tech Ed sessions get made into seminars and webinars right afterwards so that you can understand the new technologies. And then I'll come jump back to the virtual world, which is test these things out, play with these things in a virtual environment. You can go download fully created virtual hard drives, virtual environments, which are loaded with lots of data inside them, so users and Active Directory and distribution groups, so that you can actually jump into an environment and really test out and work with, try out the different things that are talked about in different chapters and so on, but actually go and sit down and set up a CCR cluster between two virtual nodes. No better way to learn it than actually do it and rip it apart and break it and fix it and do it again.
We spent a lot of time talking about what's happening now and some history of where it all came from, but what about the future? What should IT pros be preparing for?
A couple of the technologies that I really see as sort of near to medium term, but one needs to really be more advanced with. The first is, I thought the concept of multi-forest Active Directory architectures were only going to be of interest to the largest organizations. And I would talk about that for years. And it's like, okay, Microsoft, multi-forest, that's interesting. But other than really, really large organizations, nobody's going to actually do that. Well, I was thinking recently, over the last year or so, and say, organizations with the push towards hosting, that has hosted messaging mailboxes and messaging services and all of that, more and more organizations are going to end up with, functionally, a split forest. So Active Directory split between two different, I don't want to just say locations, but almost two different forests. That is, I might be housing my Exchange and OCS environment for my local users at headquarters, and I've got the scale of population, and I can build in redundancy with clusters, and I've got that for the people who are pretty much in a single location most of the time. But what about my sales organization, my support organization? What if they were hosted out on Microsoft Exchange hosting services? And in effect, that would be split from the directory that I have. Well, gee, now the concept of multi-forest or cross-forest or split forest really becomes something I need to understand, because my sales and support organization people may come and go and fired and, you know, provisioning and so on, but they're outside the organization. I'm not going to worry about that as much. I'll let that be hosted, and then that seamless organization has to be there. The other major trend right now is, and moving forward, is virtualization, right? So previously, we've consolidated our Exchange servers from branch locations to regional locations, and now we've got much larger populations that we're hosting ourselves, so running internally at our primary location, and we've got multiple servers, hardware servers, that are doing that. Well, gee, now it's possible with Hyper-V, Microsoft's virtualization technology, which is really, really excellent, and I encourage people to get your hands on and start playing with it. But now I can take virtualization, or I can take consolidation the next level, which is I can actually start putting multiple machines in a virtualized environment, virtualized world. You're going to see a lot of that, and obviously something we need to be cautious of is figure out where this makes sense and where it doesn't, and also to make sure that we make available the same resources that we would in a physical environment to a virtual server. So let's say in the area of, you know, hosting Exchange mailboxes, virtualization possible there, looking at our disk storage, probably not virtualizing the disk storage itself, but looking at our front-end services, the CASs and the hubs, those are things that are, you know, really make a lot of sense to virtualize. But if I have X number of processors and X amount of memory in the physical environment, I need to be able to dedicate that as well in the virtual environment. There are some technologies that don't present them very well towards virtualization. OCS is incredibly real-time oriented in some of its codecs, some of its handling of different protocols. OCS R2 has not released yet any virtualization plans or supported scenarios. I suspect we'll see some coming, but not all of the pieces of OCS. If one is allowed to do that, once the support requirements come out, there will be, you know, very specific parameters that one must abide by. And then finally, if we're going to do all of this, we need to also remember that these virtual resources are the same and need to be managed much like other resources do, other servers in the organization. So you really want to embrace tools that are going to give you that are going to provide management tools, such as System Center Virtual Machine Manager, so you can manage servers as a group, so that you're not forgetting that, gee, I need to patch all of my virtual servers, because they will get the same exploits, they will have the same issues, and some of these virtual machines, with caution I will say, you may make available through your firewalls to the outside world. So they've got to be patched like all of your other servers do.
You know, that sort of brings to mind, you know, we've been talking sort of very much on the technology side, but at the very beginning of this conversation, you mentioned the fact that you're sort of involved with IT professional groups and user groups, and you're even recommendations of, you know, people sort of being aware that their service is available from them. Well, can you talk more about that, you know, about the broader IT community and the groups that are out there and why IT pros should get involved?
Sure. Well, let me start. I've been doing user groups since forever, I think. I can't even go far enough back. But let me start here local in Boston on some of the things I'm doing local, and then we'll scale that up, and we'll talk about the areas that people can and should get involved. I run an exchange group here in Boston. It has currently over 1,000 registered users. It was the largest the last time I actually looked at any numbers, but I don't know if that still holds or not. But the truth is that so we meet on a quarterly basis, and people actually come in, and we talk about different tech issues that people might be having. People get to get to know other people in the local community, IT community. We talk about we bring in different experts talking about technologies themselves, maybe up-and-coming technologies, or a technology specialization area that I've been getting a lot of different questions, per se. And we'll often bring in external vendors to talk about their technologies as well. Well, actually, no. We don't bring in external vendors. We're careful about. We don't bring them in to talk about their technology. We bring them to talk about a topic of interest to the members, and then we let them put in a couple of slides about their technology. Really important in the user group world not to have product pitches and marketing to be what it's about. It's about learning and saying, hey, there's these other pieces and other solutions and other approaches to solving problems, and let's see what we can all learn from that. So that's sort of a local meeting for us. We have sort of the beginning of extensions to that, to the wider community as well. So my group, Exchange Server Boston, has a very active listserv, right? So not everybody comes to all of my meetings. In fact, I'd be surprised if I ever got 1,000 users at my meetings. But I have users who are on board because they've heard me speak around the world, and they want to know what the group is doing. I don't expect some of my international users to actually attend, but they're really interested in what's being discussed. What are the topics of importance? What are the things that have reached the level where they're worthy of having a presentation? Or who are the cool vendors who are experts in a particular area or the technology? And then the listserv is a way for them also to keep on tap. So if we scale that up, so that's very local, and a lot of user groups really are local. They're appealing to a population of technology experts in a particular region, in a particular location, sometimes with a particular expertise. New England, the Boston area where I am, has got a lot of user groups, but other areas have only very few user groups and maybe more general purpose than Exchange or OCS specific. So what are the things that we can learn? Well, from other user groups, I can learn about other tangential technologies. I can get some of the things that we've been discussing here, lessons learned, success stories. How do I find good speakers? How do I tap those resources? Colinus is an umbrella organization of user groups worldwide in the IT pro arena. So Colinus is, think of it as a sharing, a clearinghouse or a sharing of organizations about user groups that people can, one, do the lookups and say, can I find a user group in my area? And it's very basic. I should be able to go online, go to the Colinus website, and say, I'm looking for an exchange group, or I'm looking for an OCS group, or I'm looking for a clustering group in my particular arena, in my particular area and locale. And I can get that information. Colinus provides lots of other services towards IT pro groups. And by the way, Colinus has separate from Colinus, actually, there's another group, which is INETA. INETA is a developer-focused umbrella organization of user groups. But other things that we provide are speaker bureaus, right? So the ability to share who are the good speakers, who are the available speakers who would like to talk on a topic. We provide advancement opportunities or notification of kinds of opportunities that will help people advance within their IT careers. You know, we talk about user groups, and I love getting up in front of people and talking about these technologies. And I never had formal training in how to do that, but it's something that comes across naturally. But I know other people who are absolutely afraid of standing up in front of a group. So there may be services that that a columnist can provide, working with other organizations who are really organizations that actually create good speakers, and we can provide services. I believe actually we have Comenis has a recent agreement with the folks at Toastmasters to actually help build people into better speakers. And so those are some of the kinds of things that we can do.
So those are some really great insights in terms of user groups and the value that comes from them. Are there any other kind of things you want to share, or do you think that pretty much covers it?
Well, I think that's pretty much it there. Let's see, I had a other example, though, of the user group world, which is both Comenis and iNeta together are working for TechNet. TechNet's is Microsoft's large conference of the year. Comenis and the iNeta folks are working on what are called Birds of a Feather sessions for TechEd this year, which will be in Los Angeles in May. And working together to create additional sessions, which are really discussion sessions. So you come to a Microsoft conference and you want to hear, you know, what's the latest session talking about a particular technology, you know, Microsoft speaker, a third-party speaker. Birds of a Feather sessions are the sessions that go around everything else and sort of on the perimeter and plugged in here and there, but could be people talking on a topic, sometimes user group leaders or discussion list leaders or other people who say, hey, I'd like to just have a conversation about this particular topic of interest to the world, like how do I structure my business as a consultant to IT pros or in a down economy. And so that's another organization that that's another way that that Comenis and iNeta help organizations or help IT professionals, help them grow and make their expertise available.
Well, that brings up an interesting area. You mentioned TechEd earlier in this interview today, and you just mentioned it again. So you're going to be there?
Oh, well, of course. I'll be at TechEd. I'll be helping out with the Birds of a Feather sessions. You can find me some of the time at the Comenis booth in the expo area, and I hope to see some of you there.
Can you provide more details, the date, time sort of information?
Sure. Let's see. TechEd in the U.S. this year, or the North America will be. Hang on, I'm just bringing that up here. TechEd is May 11th through the 17th. No, excuse me. May 11th through the 15th. That will be TechEd in Los Angeles. And if you do a search for TechEd 2009, you'll find it there.
Sounds interesting, and I guess you know you're a key driver with all these organizations, but also with Microsoft as well. So, really interesting. I guess I encourage the audience to go and talk to Lee.
All right, I look forward to seeing some of them and talking to you there.
Okay, and then finally, in closing, where do you have the most fun?
Well, if we're talking about, you know, in the front of these technologies and all of that, it's standing in front of a user group and speaking and talking about messaging and related technologies. Other than that, you know, non-technology wise, it's hanging out with my kids and watching them grow up.
I guess that's true of many of us, right?
Right.
Well, Lee, you know, we will continue to follow your many significant contributions, and we thank you for sharing your time, wisdom, and accumulated deep insights with us. This concludes our exclusive interview with Lee Benjamin, top-ranking international messaging architect, an expert in Windows technologies, Unified Communications and Messaging, Microsoft Exchange Server Architecture Most Valuable Professional, MCT, Chairman of Exchange Server Boston, and Secretary on the Global Board of Commerce.